welcome to Comic Talk Today for Wednesday, July 11th, 2018. My name is Martin, and today is New Comic Book Day. But I'm not talking about comics. Well, that's a lie, too. This is Comic Talk Today, after all. I talk comics every day. This episode will be a listener question rapid-fire episode. And by rapid-fire, well, we'll see how rapid that is. But I've got quite a few questions I want to get through. Thank you to everyone who sent them in. I love getting questions. I love talking about them on the show. Let's get on to them, shall we? First up, one DC obscure villain that could actually be an impact player instead of a wasted one-off character. That's an easy one. The right answer is always the Ten-Eyed Man. Why are you asking this question? Don't you know this by now, that Ten-Eyed Man is the greatest Batman villain of all time, followed very closely by the Eraser? Come on, guys. Don't you listen to this? Ten-Eyed Man. I don't know. I don't know if I'd pick Ten-Eyed Man, actually. I think one of my favorites is from the animated series, King Tut. I wish they put King Tut in... Let me tell you, if King Tut was actually in continuity, he would be an awesome villain. Awesome villain. Can you imagine, after the revelations of Batman 50, if we learned that everything that's happened in the past 50 issues had been masterminded by King Tut instead of Bane? God, that would be awesome. So yeah, maybe King Tut. I love that character. He's fantastic. Dream Team writing a Marvel book, who would it be and what book would it be? I think that's an easy one. Are you ready? Give you a second to guess. Let's see if you guess. Nope, you all guessed wrong. The right answer is Swamp Thing by Cullen Bunn, illustrated by Phil Hester. Somebody needs to make that happen. How about that? What indie creators would you like to see make the jump to Marvel or DC? Oh man, that's a really hard question. I should have thought about that before I asked it on here. I mean, if you had asked me this question, like, let's say a year ago, I think the answer would have been pretty simple for me. It would have been Zach Thompson, Long and Adler. Of course, they're already at Marvel. They're doing Cable. They're working on the new Spider book. That's going to be a tie-in to the Edge of Spider-Geddon. Is that what it's called? Maybe it's just called Spider-Geddon. I don't know. So I would have picked those guys. I mean, obviously, like, Rosenberg, Donnie Cates, all those guys, but they're all at Marvel already. If I had to pick somebody now, God, that's a really good question. I really enjoy, so I talked about Submerged at the beginning of the week on Monday's episode, and I really love Vida Ayala's work. I've been trying to get into some of the other stuff that she's done, and I'm really, really enjoying it. I think once her Livewire book comes out at Valiant, people are going to really start to take notice on what she can do for a superhero book, so that might be my pick. And of course, I mean, I have to put in Andrew Shaw and Will Platon on there because those guys are amazing. Previous guests of the show, you know, have I talked about Cul-de-sac enough? Have you read Cul-de-sac? Maybe that should be the new meme, Ronnie. Forget have you read Ghost Fleet. The new meme is have you read Cul-de-sac. But yeah, I would love to see those guys on anything, really. I mean, I would love to see that book available in the US, first of all. So there's that. Let's go on to some DC 100-page giant questions. Why are there so many of these? Guys, I talk about this, like, on how many episodes? All right, let's do it. Any news on if the new DC 100-page giants are coming to Asda? Asda is, of course, the Walmart arm of the United Kingdom. And the answer, shortly, appears to be no. Why that is, I don't know. They're also not going to be at the Australian branch. I don't remember what that one is. I know there was a comment made about that. So as far as I know, the answer is no comment, because maybe they're not. Why, I don't know. I mean, our comics are sent over there through Diamond, so if Diamond's got a presence, why are they not there? I'm assuming Diamond distributes these, right, directly to Walmart? I don't know. But even if they don't, it doesn't matter. There's already a distribution relationship there, so these should be available wherever there's a Walmart, which I'm assuming is pretty much everywhere in the world. Hope that answers your question. Can you believe the aftermarket prices on these? No, I can't. It's crazy. I will say they have come down quite a bit. As of the time that I'm recording this, you can get them for like 10 or 15 bucks a piece. Which, I mean, I guess it's not that bad for even a 100-page giant, but definitely not the $4.99 that they're going for. When these were first coming out, like that weekend that they came out, they were like 23, 25 bucks a piece, which is just outrageous. Outrageous. I say go talk to your local Walmart and find out when they restock them and just go that day. That way you won't miss out. You don't need to go on eBay to get them. Or, you know, just wait a year and a half until they put them in trade, because I'm sure that's going to happen. If each Walmart only, if each Walmart only got four copies of each book, I think that's still a good number in today's numbers. Your thoughts? Is that the case? I was trying to figure that out. I know most of the Walmarts receive more copies of Batman and Superman, which makes the most sense. The copies on Justice League and Teen Titans were a little bit lower. I think Teen Titans may have had the lowest print run on these. I don't know what the exact numbers are. I think four is probably about right. Four or five per box. I don't know if anyone has seen the display boxes, but they're, it's just like a little shelf and it's got four slots on it, one for each book. And from what I've seen, the Teen Titans was growing the quickest. And I don't know if it's because that's kind of more the market of who would be at Walmart, or if they actually sent lower copies. But if it's four copies, I think that's pretty decent. And I mean, that would account to what, like 12,000 copies of per book every 2 weeks. I think that's pretty damn good. So we'll see. I don't know if we'll ever see actual numbers on these things, because I don't know if they're being put out by Diamond. If somebody knows, let me know. But I know definitely at the Walmarts, they're being restocked by a third party and not directly from Walmart distribution. So we may not see these numbers. I don't know. But if anybody's got the information, feel free at Geekvine, nerdylegion@gmail.com. In relation to the 100-page giants, do you know any non-comic book readers that picked it up? Well, the answer to you, sir, is I don't know anybody that doesn't read comic books, because everybody reads comic books. It's the greatest medium of entertainment of all time. So does that answer your question? To be honest, I don't know. I haven't talked to my non-comic book reading friends. I do have those, believe it or not. I'm sure most of you know people that don't read comic books, if you look at it statistically. But I haven't. It has not come up in conversation. I mean, the aisle that these things are on is not like something that you would walk by, right? Like, you'd have to physically go to the location. Even though, as I mentioned on yesterday's episode, they're at the front of the store, they're in between registers. It's not like an aisle that you walk through, right? It's between two registers. So, maybe kind of a weird spot. Like, you have to know that they're there, or maybe go to actively pursue some other collectible that's there, like magic cards, or Yu-Gi-Oh cards, or the little pop figures, or whatever else. But, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I haven't heard anybody talking about it. The only people I hear talking about it are comic book readers. But generally, that's the people that I spent the most time talking to, so I guess that would kind of make sense. But I'm pretty curious, and maybe I'll ask around. I'll ask some of my friends and see what they say, see if maybe their kids are interested. But as far as I know, it is comic book fans that are picking these up. Does that make the whole thing successful? I don't know. I mean, I guess technically, because they're being sold out. So, yes. Did the colors look weird to you on Catwoman? Yes. But I think for a different reason than what you're thinking. So I picked up, we had this discussion on Twitter, the person that asked this question, a little bit, because I picked it up digitally. I think she had picked it up digitally as well. And the colors do look a little off digitally. From my understanding, they look much more off on print. And the reason for that is because the book is being put out in a non-glossy paper stock. And again, not newsprint, but non-glossy paper stock. The amount of ink that goes into the page is different. And I think that will definitely show on the print copy. Now, with that said, I have not looked at a print copy yet. I'm going to try to go this weekend and pick one up. I'm sure there will be plenty at the shop. Not because the book's not selling well, but because I'm sure the shop's ordered a ton of these. With that said, digitally, it does look a little off, but I think the majority of the reason for that is that it's Laura Allred doing the coloring. And Laura's got a very distinct style of coloring that I think oftentimes makes the book look a little odd if you're not used to it, right? Because the style that she uses is very different than most colorists. I think most colorists try to complement the work and kind of get out of the way, whereas Laura's work kind of becomes an integral part of the page itself. And I was thinking about that. What was she doing? She was doing the Silver Surfer book because her husband Mike Allred was doing the art on that, so she colored it. I believe she colored the Allred stuff in Infinity Countdown as well. And if you look at those books, you can see the style that I'm talking about. It's very similar. So I think it looks different more because of who is coloring and not necessarily what's being done on the page. Although again, on print, it will look very different because, you know, a non-glossy paper takes a different amount of ink. This is something that, like, as comic readers, we don't often think about, right? Like, how does the paper affect things, whether it's print or digital, things like that. But definitely there is an art to inking and coloring a book on different kinds of paper. And I know Peter Cimetti over at Alterna, of course, they do all their books on newsprint, and even that requires different ink levels. And he often talks about, you know, how to do your inking, what colors to choose, the amount of ink required in each one. I think it's really interesting and maybe extremely technical and not something that most people are interested in. But I hope that answers your question. Which characters will die in Heroes in Crisis? They will all die because they're in crisis. I think the reference to this is the little blurb. Maybe it was an ad or a preview or something that came out showing a bunch of different characters. And it was kind of to advertise the Heroes in Crisis book that's going to be put out by Tom King. I think that's in September or October. Of course, this is the book where Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman create this, we'll say like a superhero spa, a place where heroes can go to kind of get their mind away from the troubles of being a hero. And as part of the story, we know that there's going to be something that happens and some characters may be blamed for the destruction of the sanctuary. There's going to be characters that die. And in relation to the question of who will die, because I think that's part of the ad that's in question here, my guess would be Poison Ivy and Booster Gold. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Booster Gold, of course, was featured recently on an arc of Batman right before we got this whole wedding thing. And it was a very interesting dive into who Booster is. And I actually really enjoyed that arc quite a bit. I think the way Tom King handled Booster Gold was pretty well done. The thing about Booster Gold is it's a character that you can actually kind of kill and bring back at any time because of the whole time travel thing. It's something that came up, for example, in the Multiple Man book that I talked about a couple weeks ago by Matthew Rosenberg over at Marvel. And, you know, that Multiple Man is not the original Jamie Madrox. It's a copy of him that survived Death of X. But, you know, that's how they're bringing the character back, because the original is dead. And that's something that could be done with Booster as well. So I'm not concerned about Booster never reappearing, but it'd be an interesting way of getting rid of one version of Booster, right? Because time travel's weird, guys, you know? A lot of people hate time travel stories because you can do so many weird and wacky things with it, and I understand that. But, you know, this could be one way to kill off one of these alternate Booster Golds. Now, Poison Ivy, the reason I chose her is she was featured in Batman as well. However, the reason I want to pick her is because I don't think that Poison Ivy is used well enough over at DC lately. And it kind of irks me to some extent because I love Poison Ivy so much as a character. You know, they can't figure out if they want to make her a hero or a villain or make her part of the Green or just be a meta or whatever, this, that, and the other. And that's a little disconcerting to me. As much as I love the character, I would love to see her center stage somewhere. And to go with the logic a little bit with Booster Gold, we saw this kind of thing. I hate to bring it up because I know some people don't watch the show, but on Gotham, on Fox, we've had, I think, like 3 or 4 different actresses portray Poison Ivy. And the reason that was changed, you know, depended, like she was like gassed or something, and that made her go from a kid to an adult, and then she was a vixen, and then she was dead, and then she wasn't dead. I don't know. It's so weird the way that they did Poison Ivy there. I don't understand why they couldn't do her properly in that show either. The young Poison Ivy is actually really interesting, but I guess they needed somebody to hang out with Oswald. I'm not sure. I would love to see DC decide what they're going to do with the character. And, you know, there was a point where the whole Poison Ivy being part of the Green thing was really interesting. Of course, I'm making a reference to Swamp Thing. You know, with the new Swamp Thing TV show coming out, I think it's proper time to bring in a Swamp Thing book. Go back to one of the first questions that was asked in this episode, by the way, where I made a Swamp Thing reference. Make that happen. But I would love to see Poison Ivy in that. You know, I think that works so well. Why not make her this almost otherworldly character? I think that may be the proper place for her. And I don't know. We'll see. But for that reason, I think maybe they should kill Ivy off and let her rest for a little bit and then bring her back with a really interesting and compelling story with an amazing creative team that can actually make that character make sense. I hope that answers your question. What has taken you so long to read Injustice? Do you know how many comics I talk about on this podcast? Think about that for a second. If I'm reading 25 books a week, plus whatever else I read, do you think I have time to read Injustice? However, I'm glad that I did, so thanks for the question. I'm glad that I did, because it is a very fast read, so I'm pretty sure I can get through the last, like, 5 years' worth of stories in, I don't know, probably a few weeks. They're not very long. I mean, they can't be but, like, 10 pages each. Right? They're put out weekly digitally, so it's pretty quick, but I'm really enjoying it. I'll be talking about them maybe once I'm done with the first few volumes of the thing, and I'll devote some time to talking about Injustice, but thanks for that. If I were to read a Grant Morrison Bat trade, what would I read? I think the answer to that is also pretty simple. The correct answer is Batman and Son. It was a long-running story, and you can get the story differently depending on how you get it. I would recommend picking up the Batman and Son Deluxe Edition. I know that may be a little steeper than some people want to pay for a story, but Deluxe Editions are fantastic, and that one actually has some of these stories that took place after the arc was technically done, even though they're part of the arc. It includes a lot of the Black Glove stuff that happened immediately after the Batman and Son arc, and it does tie in quite a bit. Of course, Batman and Son does feature one of my favorite Grant Morrison Batman issues, and it's a really weird one. It's one that I didn't pick up when it came out. I totally missed it. I think I was out of comics at that time for a couple of months, and then it took me like a year to find this issue. a year because it wasn't easy to get comics online at the time. And I mean, I guess this book sold out and eventually found a copy, and that's Batman 666. It is I guess we can maybe say Elseworlds, although it does take place in continuity in that arc, but it features Damian Wayne as an adult and he has taken over the mantle of Batman, and it is a fantastic read. Fantastic read. In many ways, he reminded me of the Dick Grayson Batman that we saw in that Booster Gold Batman arc. Really, really interesting. So Batman and Son, definitely for sure, is going to be on that list. Batman RIP as well, I would put on there. It's a little bit longer read, and you may need some additional information in order to understand what's happening. Of course, there was a bunch of stuff that came in after that, like when Batman died, and then the return of Bruce Wayne stuff. So that may be a lot of additional reading you don't want to do, but Batman and Son, highly, highly recommend it. And of course, the Batman and Robin series that Grant Morrison did with, I'm going to get hit if I don't answer this correctly. We're going to say Frank Quietly, I think that's right, did the Batman and Robin story, and that was awesome. And that was the time we got introduced to Professor Pig as well, who's a fantastic villain. I would love to see more of that, by the way, in comics, DC, make it happen. Yeah, Batman and Robin was fantastic. So those would be my choices on that question. Will a creator's race, sex, or gender alone encourage you to buy their book? The short answer to that is no. Do you buy books for a reason other than the impression of the story? I think that's a more interesting part of your question. The short answer to that, I would say, is no as well. The biggest draw to me when I buy a comic book is, what is the story about? Is it in a genre that I enjoy? Does it have characters that I dig? That's number one. Number two is this book trying to do something different and interesting? Right? Because I don't want rehashes of the same stories over and over again. And of course, I talk all the time about how comics are cyclical. You know, you get the same cycles every, 15, 20 years. Stories get repeated, characters get killed, they get brought back to life, this and the other. After a while, it becomes not as interesting. And so if it's that kind of story, of course, I want to see fresh new takes on this story that we're already familiar with. For example, Marvel used to do a lot of these What If comics, which are fantastic. If you ever get a chance to read the Marvel What Ifs, highly recommended. They're all one-shot stories, so there's nothing to know previously or afterwards. All one-shots, they're self-contained, really amazing stories. Art, I mean, it depends on the art, but the stories for the majority are really, really interesting. And what's really interesting about them is a lot of the stuff that Marvel has been doing, I would say within the last 5 or 10 years, are almost like expansions of some of these What If stories, right? Like when the What Ifs came out, you read them, you thought like, oh yeah, these are fun stories, I love them, like whatever, let's go back to the regular stuff. Now that, you know, continuity has gotten so convoluted, there's so much stuff going on, it's almost like some of these guys that grew up reading these books want to actually make these happen, right? And they put these What If stories in continuity, and they work out so, so well. There's some really interesting stuff on there, and I can't think of any particular issues at the top of my head, but I highly recommend you check those out. Matter of fact, if I remember correctly, there was a What If, and it was like the Inhumans versus X-Men, which is really interesting because of the whole, Inhumans, X-Men, Death of X thing, and really interesting stuff. Of course, that's all part of canon now, but I definitely recommend you check out the What Ifs. So I do look for that kind of stuff. In terms of creative team, or even publisher, I think that's tertiary for me. Of course, I think there's some publishers that do more interesting stuff than others, right? So like I talk about Vault Comics or Aftershock Comics a lot because I think the majority of the line that those publishers put out is really interesting. There's other publishers that I don't talk about as much, but I kind of want to, right? So like I've mentioned yesterday's episode, Alterna, I want to talk a little bit more about that because their books are actually pretty easy to get and the price point is great. Another publisher is like Action Lab. You know, for a long time, I didn't really follow Action Lab because to me, it was more like the Zombie Tramp publisher than anything else. But I'm finding more and more stuff that I like over at Action Lab. And matter of fact, they have a really interesting book next week, 12 Devils Dancing. And hopefully, if all works out, I'll have Erica Schultz on and we'll be talking about that. But I mean, they put out some really great stuff. And I think that's a publisher that you shouldn't sleep on, right? Most people kind of tend to be like, okay, I'm going to the comic shop. I'm picking up everything Marvel or everything DC or everything Batman or whatever. And don't even think about what it could be, right? And don't even look over some of the other books, which is kind of upsetting. You know, a lot of comic shops do a really good job at mixing in some of these indie books into the Marvel lineups, right? So they might do alphabetically, for example. I know a lot of comic shops do that. They'll put the books in alphabetically, which first of all, it makes it easy to find, yes. But second of all, it actually gives you an incentive to gloss over everything and see what else is available and not just go to a Marvel section or a DC section. Because those books sell themselves to an extent, right? I mean, even if it's not a high-selling book, you'll still know, like, okay, it's Marvel, like, I know I'm gonna go look for this. What's a book that I liked? Let's do Midnighter, for example, because that's not even out anymore. I'm a big fan of Midnighter, I'm gonna go pick that up. What else is around the M's? You know? Something like that. Most people don't do that. They'll be like, okay, I'm gonna look on the top left-hand corner and just see if it says Marvel or DC on it, and that's what I'm picking up. And that's kinda sad, right? And I think that's why a lot of times publishers have to play around with the formatting of the books. You know, maybe make the logo bigger or get rid of the publisher, put the image does like the stuff on the back, like putting the barcode on the back, stuff like that. Like, I'm okay with it. If you put the barcode on the back because it makes the cover more appealing for people, more enticing for them to pick it up, I'm good with that. And, I'll talk about that at some point in an episode. I'll do a full episode just on that. Probably not next week, but the week after. And, you know, there's different ways to actually properly shop for comics, right? Other than to look for Marvel or DC. And the thing is, like, even with DC, right? So their B covers now are virgin covers. They don't have the logo on it. All you have is the cover image. And I love that so much. It makes the covers look so beautiful. But it's tough for some retailers to display their books that way, right? Because a lot of them, you'll see them in waterfall racks, and there's so many interesting on that. Well, I'll talk about that when I do that episode. Let's just say in 2 weeks. I'll talk about that a little bit more. But, yeah, so those are some of the things that I look for. Do I kickstart? I do kickstart, not as often as I used to, although lately I've done quite a few. Of course, I backed Colin Lawler's book, Spirits. I had him on a couple weeks ago. I backed, what else? I ended up doing Metro last minute. That's the Cullen Bunn book. I wasn't going to do it because one of the things that I look for is how quickly is the book being put out. So what I don't want to do is back a book and have to wait 6 months to a year to get it, right? I'm a patient person. However, I don't want to buy something and have to wait so long, right? So if the leeway between the end of the Kickstarter and when the book will be shipped out to me is, you know, within like 3 months, I'm totally good with that. Once you get past the 6 month line, it's a little bit harder for me. And, you know, even if it's like digitally, for example, right? Even if I do a digital only backing on a book, the reason for that is I understand that doing a print book will take a lot longer, right? You need to have the money from the Kickstarter. That's generally why these things are done. You need to have the money for the Kickstarter to be able to pay a printer to put these books together. Then you need to get everything together, get all the awards together, you know, get a list together, send these copies out. And that takes time. Totally get that. But, you know, if I support a book on a digital-only tier, there's no reason for me to have to wait 6 months like somebody else would that's getting a print copy. I'm going to get back to that in a second. So if I'm doing a digital backing, I would really expect it to be, you know, within like 4 to 6 weeks that I would get the PDF or whatever else it is, right? Because you assume, and this is another thing that I look for, you assume that when these Kickstarters are being done, the book is done, right? All they need the money for is to actually get the book out and distributed. What I don't like seeing is people that are simply kickstarting the idea of doing something. And I think in the early days of Kickstarter, a lot of people fell into that trap. And that's why there's people that have backed Kickstarters that didn't receive it for a year, 2 years, 3 years, or never. Because the book wasn't done and, you know, they didn't do the due diligence to know kind of at what point of the project is this in, right? So I like to see that a book is finished or somewhat finished because that way I know that the deadline will be met. I also look for people that have already backed Kickstarter previously. For example, Sean Pryor has done quite a few. I know that if I back a Sean Pryor book, I'm going to get the book. I don't care so much about the rewards, and I think that's different for a lot of people. I talked to Colin a little bit about that, because that's something that he learned from his first Kickstarter until the second one. You know, I don't think having tons of rewards is necessarily an enticement to get a book done. And I understand the reason why some creators do it, because you feel like if you add extra stuff, people are going to be like, yes, I'm going to back at this level. And that doesn't always work out that way, right? And especially if you get less people at that level, it's additional work that's not really productive work, right? Because if you had just offered your single issue for $5 or $10, whatever it is, or your trade for $20, $25, maybe add in like original art, if you want to do that, that works, right? Because that's already done. You want to do like prints or posters, do that, because that's easy to do. But when you start bringing in like all these weird stuff, like meet such and such at a con, or have like a 10-minute Skype conversation with this person and then the other, like, that's not interesting to me. Not interesting at all. I do like the, like, additional add-on levels. Okay. That I do like because it's not a reward that's offered, but if I want it, I can get it. Right. So like, get the book for $25, add a second copy for an extra 10. Like, that's a great deal. I might do that and give a copy to somebody. Or like, here's the book for $20, add $5 and get a enamel pin or whatever, something like that. Like, I'm good with that too, right? Because it's not a forced reward to get the additional cash. But if it happens, if I'm really passionate about the project, then I'll do it. So I like those kind of things. Now, I will say this, even though I talked a lot about digitally backing some of these things, the majority of the ones that I back, I actually back not digitally, but in the print level. Because I think, in particular, the types of creators that I back don't have a huge presence already, right? A lot of them are indie creators. And so I feel like I would want their work in print for some reason over a digital copy. And I don't know what the actual rationale behind that is for me, to be honest. I'm sure there's quite a few reasons. But for some reason, I feel like I feel better about supporting the project because then I can see it in print, right? Because a lot of these guys want to get into comics, or gals, want to get into comics and want to see their book published. And, you know, they're fine just doing the digital stuff. But there's something about that print copy, right? There really is. It's a psychological thing where you actually created something physical. And I think that's really important in particular for artists because they're creating stuff, right? That's their livelihood. So I do tend to support these things in a physical fashion whenever I can. Now, if it's a huge Kickstarter like somebody did, I don't know, like a $200,000 Kickstarter and they needed like $5,000, well, I mean, they probably don't need my extra money. You know what I mean? And those projects are few and far between for me. I tend to support the smaller Kickstarters, but I know everyone's different. But I'm actually curious, if you support Kickstarters, how is it that you support them? And what kind of things do you look for when you support Kickstarters? Have you been burned by Kickstarters, or have you had pretty good luck with them? I know right now I just backed the new Matt Kint Mind Management Kickstarter. That's really interesting. This one I'm doing digitally because the Kickstarter is an original mind management comic book, but it also has a record, a vinyl record attached to it. And if you check out, I'll put a link in the show notes. If you check out the Kickstarter, you'll see a video of Matt discussing why he's doing this. And I think it's so interesting because Matt plays around with the comic book format so much, in particular in mind management. It's amazing the amount of stuff that you can find not directly on the page that you're reading. Like there's stuff out on the margins and, you know, stuff that you can read backwards, stuff that you don't know what it means until 20 issues down the line. Really amazing work. And, you know, one thing he explained is he grew up reading these comics that came with vinyl records. And, you know, as you read them, they have sound effects, so there's like narration and things like that. And I thought that was really interesting and something new and unique. And of course, I love Matt Kent, so I backed it. And I backed it at the digital level because I don't have a vinyl record. I don't have a record player. Okay. I don't know anybody that's got a record player. Matter of fact, let me rephrase that. I think I may have a record player in my laundry room because a few months ago, my wife and I were digging through her parents' attic because there was like childhood stuff that they had of my wife's. And I think in there may be a record player and I don't know what it played. I don't think it's 45s, but I'll have to go look in my laundry room because I think the case is in there. Maybe I do have a record player. And if I do, maybe I'll up my pledge on this. But I mean, the pledge that I did is $5 and you get a PDF copy of the book. And you get an MP3 file of the audio recording, okay? Then if you want the record and the physical book, I think it's 25, which I think even then is pretty damn good to have like this cool physical object that you can have to read along to or read along to you for this new original story. And Management is fantastic. I highly recommend you pick that up. If you've never read it, go check it out. What is it, like 7 volumes, 8 volumes? Just brilliant, brilliant stuff. And I love Matt Kent. So, matter of fact, I need to get Matt Kent on this podcast. We'll see if I can arrange that. I hope that answers all your questions. I want to thank you all for sending those in. I'll be doing another listener question episode probably in 2 weeks. Next week's episode is going to be a rant, and I think one that'll be interesting to you, whether you're a physical reader or a print reader, and it's going to be discussing how to fix the pull list. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Of course, you can find me on Twitter at Geekvine. NerdLegion@gmail.com is the email address. The podcast is on iTunes and Google Play, on Stitcher, on TuneIn, on a million other places. Thanks for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Therapy Thursday.